Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Hope May. I'm the director of the Center for Professional and Personal Ethics at Central Michigan University, where I also teach philosophy. This week is actually finals week at Central Michigan University, and so normally we have students doing ethics talk, but they're all busy with final exams, writing papers, etc. So instead, we have a really special show lined up for you, and I am joined tonight by a very special and repeat guest, Dr. Michael Russo. Thank you, Dr. Russo, for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And so tonight's show, to put it quite most simply, is on Aristotle, and it's on Aristotle's conception of virtue. The title of the show is Virtue and the Soul's Embodiment. And so I'm going to lay out our objective, which we normally do at the beginning of every show. And if you are a regular listener of Ethics Talk, you probably know by now that oftentimes we do not achieve our objective and that the conversation actually evolves into two or three shows. That may very well happen tonight, but I'm going to lay out the objective nonetheless and then just say a few things about it, and then we'll start the discussion. But we want to introduce you, the listener, to Aristotle's conception of virtue, and specifically the role that the body, habituation, if you're unfamiliar with Aristotle, you can think of this as practice, repetition. If you are familiar with Aristotle, you know about habituation, but the role that the body, habituation and practice, and also pain and discomfort play in Aristotle's view of virtue. And this last bit about pain, I just wanted to say up front, both for the sake of if we don't get to this part of the objective in tonight's conversation, but also if we do, to make the connection just right up front with our show last week, which was called The Splendor of Suffering, you can access all of our shows on iTunes. And so if you haven't listened to that show, I encourage you to go back and listen to that because it was a really interesting conversation. But at any rate, what we talked about in that show was this sort of inevitability of suffering and how bad events happen to you, that sort of thing. And we talked about the importance of framing. This is some wisdom that we get from the Stoic school of philosophy, from Buddhism, also from positive psychology, Viktor Frankl we mentioned, but the idea of you always have the choice to interpret things in a way that is less painful to the degree that you're interpreting it now. To quote Viktor Frankl, to choose our attitude in any situation is the last of the human freedoms. So we spent quite a bit of time talking about these sort of bad events that happen to you inevitably. It's part of human life, and how the best way to, so, quote-unquote, cope with that is by really focusing on the fact that it is within your power to interpret things in a way that's less debilitating. But just up front, tonight I want to draw this distinction that we're talking about, because we will hopefully get to the role that pain and discomfort play in virtue. And so I just want to make that known up front that what we're talking about tonight in terms of pain and suffering is not really in terms of framing. It's like almost, I don't know if you want to agree or disagree with this, Mike, but like the kind of pain and suffering and discomfort that Aristotle talks about as being essential to the development of virtue in a sense, does not involve, you know, judgment and interpretation. I mean, I know in the sense that it does, but would you agree with that that much?
Sure. In a sense, it does, and in a sense, it doesn't.
Yeah, and so I just wanted to just put that out front right now. So if you have listened to our show last week, it's sort of percolating, and maybe you're going to see some connections between last week's discussion and tonight. So if that's not clear now, hopefully at the end of the hour it will be clear. And so, Dr. Russo, can I call you Mike?
Yes.
I should disclose that Dr. Russo, Mike, is an old college friend. Mike and I were in philosophy class together back in the day in New Jersey at William Patterson College, which is now William Patterson University. And Dr. Russo went off to graduate school at University of Maryland, where I came to Michigan, Michigan State University. So I just want it to be known that Mike and I have been talking about Aristotle for quite some time over the span of years, and we're really striving tonight to make things very clear. And in order for us to, and we don't know if we're going to achieve that objective, but we did actually have to, you know, talk for a long time to get to this point. So the first question, Mike, is, okay, so we're talking about Aristotle's view of virtue. And I think the first question that we should ask is, what is Aristotle's view of virtue?
Well, I think it would be helpful and instructive to start by kind of saying what his view of virtue is not.
Cool.
In some ways, we have many associations with that word virtue in English that are not really intrinsic to the notion of virtue that Aristotle has in mind, which is represented in Greek by the word arete. In English, and I've tested this in my classes over the years and have asked repeatedly, just for the first thing that comes to mind when you hear, you know, virtue or a virtuous person, and the central notion that most people seem to associate with virtue in English, you know, ordinarily seems to be something that's related to concern for the welfare of other people. And that certainly is a very important notion. In some ways, you know, even I have even elicited the response that virtue means being a goody-two-shoes. A virtuous person is a goody-goody, and I, you know, almost relished in that response so that I was ready to say, you know, this is so much not what Aristotle is talking about. Well, the concern for the welfare of other people is definitely a central notion that Aristotle has in mind with regard to virtue. His idea that the man, as it were, is born for the city-state, or human beings are political animals and so forth, is Aristotle's notion that social interrelationships are very central to our humanity, so the regard for the welfare of other people is no small thing. But it's not the central sort of focus of the idea of virtue as Aristotle and other ancient Greek philosophers have in mind. So then, what is virtue, or arete, for Aristotle? In terms of a one-word sort of translation, many people prefer to use excellence as a translation. And this harmonizes with the fact that arete, or virtue, in Aristotle's conception is a much wider notion than even not only things related to the welfare or concern for other people, but even things that extend beyond any kind of moral context or even human situation, so that you could speak, for instance, of the virtue of a knife or a computer or a car. It would sound strange to say that a car is virtuous, but in Greek it would make sense to say that some artifact has arete, because you would be expressing the notion that it has the excellence that makes it effective at performing its function. This, I think, is a pretty decent way to describe what Aristotle means by virtue or arete, the power or set of characteristics that a thing must possess to be effective at performing its function.
Okay, so going back to this idea that the Greeks would be completely comfortable by talking, speaking of a knife as something that has virtue, just to sort of bring it into the 21st century, it's like you said, you know, does it make sense for us to talk about artifacts, man-made objects, as having virtue? But, of course, I would say that in our own culture, there is this idea sort of lurking in the background of our consciousness. And so the idea of, like, a Rolex watch or, if you're a real watch aficionado, a Lange watch. But everybody knows what a Rolex is or a Montblanc pen. And there is in our culture this idea that there are some, you know, very skillfully made objects, and that these are prized by people and they cost a lot of money. Well, similarly, there's this idea that human beings, there can be like a Rolex human being, so to speak.
Yes.
And so that's one way in which Aristotle's view of virtue differs. But also this idea that other regard, while not totally irrelevant, right? And it, as you say, it's an important piece of Aristotle's view of virtue. In fact, he has a whole chapter devoted to friendship and its role in the good life. But the focus at the heart of virtue is really oneself, and like being a Rolex of a person, if you will.
I mean,
that
would
be the theme of tonight.
Sure. I would also throw in, just in case it helps anyone's understanding to put it in such terms, you could say that being a virtuous person in this sense is like being a virtuoso at being human. That there's a certain kind of way of living life that is characteristic of human beings as a potentiality. And to fill that potentiality with skill and beauty and grace and so forth, and so with excellence, is to possess virtue. To be a good person in this sense is to be good at being human or fulfilling or realizing the human good, as Aristotle.
Oh, sorry to cut you off. I'm just getting too excited.
Okay.
But just for our listeners, and you and I know this, but Aristotle makes a big to-do about role models. And can you think of anybody in, I mean, you said, you know, people, you've mentioned the idea that when you ask your students this, what virtue is, they mention something like the idea of a goody two-shoes. Okay, but if we sort of reframe the question and understand virtue in the way that Aristotle understands it, and that, as you said, it's like living human life as a virtuoso human being, can you think of anybody that the average person would clearly identify as a person who exhibits virtuosity in living a human life?
You know, that's a tricky question. I mean, in terms of who would be identified as such by many people, that might be a different question than who actually is such an example of a person. I recall asking, I recall asking many times in class for the same basic question. And one example that I thought was, you know, pretty good, actually, was Bono. I mean, I don't know if he would qualify by Aristotle's standards as being, you know, a phronimos or a wise person, you know, ultimately. But I think he is a pretty good example, who is a person well known, who is successful in life, and not simply successful at, like, ratifying. You know, I don't know Bono personally, so I couldn't say, but it appears that Bono's success extends beyond just the gratification of any old desire. It seems to have some kind of, like, meaning and deeper quality. I mean, I don't know.
Okay.
I would think that many people would identify like Buddha or someone like that as being an example of such a person, or Aristotle himself, perhaps.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm just trying to think, like, in our world today, who people would point to, if anybody. But I want to also say at this point that if you want to call in, and if you have a role model in mind, we are going to take calls at this point, 646-727-3928. If you want us to clear up anything, or if you have some further thoughts about Aristotle's view of virtue. Okay, so what we have on the floor is this idea that virtue has to do with living as a virtuoso human being. Now, can you sort of put some meat on those bones? And like, what,
sure,
for Aristotle, does that look like, such a person?
Well, okay. One thing would be for anyone who is interested in like getting down and dirty to the details, check out Nicomachean Ethics, Book 2, Chapter 5 and 6. That's where Aristotle really sits down and says, let's figure out what virtue actually is. But I would say that a good way to just get the basic picture is to say that okay, virtue is a skill or power or aptitude, as it were, to live well as a human being. What does that mean? For Aristotle, this has a direct connection to what he calls the function of a human being, or the ergon in Greek, the characteristic function or identifying characteristic that is what our humanity most essentially consists in. And so, what this amounts to in sort of more particular terms is, to put it in a word, I think, obviously we lose a little bit in just reducing it to a single idea, but basically making wise choices, in effect, about how to live your life, and choices that come out of some kind of insight or rational illumination, or a quote-unquote aha sort of moment where you have a realization of some kind.
Sure.
In Aristotle's view, as he lays out in his so-called function argument in Nicomachean Ethics, Book 1, Chapter 7, he explains that we could figure out what well-being is for a human being if we could figure out what the human ergon or human function is. And so, he says this must be something peculiar to human beings, like our identifying characteristic. Mm. And he asks, you know, what is this? And so he ponders, you know, is it being alive and reproducing and nourishing oneself? Well, he says it can't be that, because while that's true about human life, that we have those powers and capacities, that's not the characteristic thing of humanity, because all living things have the same power. And he asks, what about sensory perception? Because we have that, you know, activity that displays life, like a living thing would be something that has sense perception. But while that's a marvelous and beautiful thing, and of course that's like integral to our life as human beings, it's not that one characteristic that identifies us particularly as human beings, because animals also have sensory perception. And so he concludes that the activity of living things that is like our specific characteristic that identifies our essence, as it were, as human beings, is reason or intellect or insight or illumination or what have you.
The aha moment.
The aha moment. The capacity to have a realization of some kind about truth in some deeper or higher sense than anything we would be ready to attribute to animals, at least Aristotle anyway. I think it's important to throw out, just because many of my students often, like in every time I discuss the function argument, get into an uproar about exactly how do we know exactly what animals you know, do or don't know and so forth, and that's to some extent a side question actually, I think, but Aristotle was no stranger to the intelligence of animals. He was, in fact, one of the sort of first people, perhaps, to systematize in any sense biological science. And so there is, I think we can all agree, something about human experience that is unique, that is this insight or aha type of capacity. So, what is virtue? It's this skill at living life well as a human being, and what does that entail in a sort of more extended sense? It would be to live life in a way that emerges out of or comes from or is governed by that sort of illumination about what is good and beautiful to do.
So basically, all right, so as I'm understanding it, virtue is tied to this living virtue, like a virtuoso, and a human virtuoso is someone whose life is, I mean, you know, use some colloquial language right now,
okay.
As if I haven't been doing it all along, but fully packed, maximally packed or what have you, with this sort of like aha moment, this moment of clarity that you have this as much as possible, that that is what is uniquely human, and that to live a human life like a virtuoso is to live like live life that way. Is that a safe way of putting it?
Yes, I would say so. To sustain that kind of insight and live out of it and to make choices and act in accordance with it.
And just to make it clear for our listeners, like, what's the alternative? So, I mean, I would say that we've all had this moment, right? Like, an aha moment. But just so we're clear on what we're talking about, like, what is the alternative to that? So if you're not living life that way, how are you living?
Well, unfortunately, perhaps, as Aristotle would say, how most of us actually are living is the alternative to how it would be best to live in one sense. You know, in the sense of what most of us, even if we have hopefully like achieved some measure of freedom from this condition, have all experienced having some kind of insight or knowledge or determination that a certain course of action is good or best or right, and instead acting in some contrary way, you know, somehow. We think that a certain thing is best to do, and we end up doing some other thing. That's one sort of phenomena or way of living that would be contrary to what Aristotle has in mind with virtue. But I think a more basic thing that's, in a sense, more prevalent and more at the core of the problem and the struggle that we all face is living, in effect, just out of impulses for pleasure, basically. Aristotle, you know, as I was saying, thinks that while self-nourishment or reproduction and sensory perception aren't these, like, essence of humanity, they are, nevertheless, integral to our experience as human beings, obviously. And so much of our decision-making and thinking and experience is governed by our sensory power and only employs rationality in a limited way or intelligence or insight. It's not fully empowered to take control of how we live.
Right. It's not like, to use the metaphor of a muscle, right? So it's like we all have this muscle of the aha moment. And, well, I'll say all in quotes, because you and I know what we're talking about. But anyway, all of us have this sort of like muscle for aha moments. But if we never exercise it, then something else is going to be taking over our actions and decisions.
Yes. Aristotle distinguishes in his work, the De Anima, between what he calls sensory imagination and rational imagination. So there are ways of thinking, basically, and making judgments and considering things that are motivated by our sensory experience. And there is like a use of our sensory experience in a rational way to consider things in a more a deeper way, or a more illuminated way, or more intellectual way, if you will, that takes effort and practice to develop and to awaken. I think everyone has had sort of moments where they've had those kind of experiences, but they're, by and large, involuntary. They happen maybe at random. You don't really know exactly, you know, what it was or why, but at certain moments you have a sort of deeper experience, or a more complete sort of, I would even say like a complete, more complete kind of presence in your own existence, if that makes sense. And oftentimes it just disintegrates and you find yourself back into sort of your ordinary mode of sort of going through a routine or following pleasure, essentially, based on sensory experience.
Right. So I think this is like a good time to transition, because the, you know, the title of the show is Virtue and the Soul's Embodiment, and we've been talking for about, you know, half hour on virtue and Aristotle's view of virtue. And what we've established so far is that, okay, it has something to do with like living as a virtuoso, that this has to do with sort of developing the muscle to have as many of these quote-unquote aha moments as possible, these moments of insight, these moments of clarity. But as the title of the show suggests, that the body is integral to this whole process. And so living as a human virtuoso is deeply involved with the human body, correct?
Yes.
And just to cut to the chase, in our own, the common sense view of, you know, we're talking about reason and sort of rational activity versus the activity of the senses, and it's a widely held view that the body and reason, or even the soul, if you will, are two different things. The body is one thing, the soul is another, reason is another thing. And I was wondering if you could educate us as to what Aristotle thinks about the relationship between the soul and the body, and how exactly the body is involved in these, in this aha moment.
Okay, well, this is a tricky subject, but I'll do my best. Essentially, just to put some sort of groundwork down, as it were, Aristotle does not think of the soul and the body of a human being, or any living thing for that matter, as being two distinct entities. He does not think of, as Descartes does, and as many people, not necessarily drawing from Descartes, also speak as if the soul and the body are two different things. Obviously, it would seem they have some kind of connection or relationship to each other, but then people puzzle over, like, what that is, and it becomes a big problem known in philosophy as the mind-body problem. Aristotle, to some extent, kind of sideswipes that whole entire issue and says at one point in his De Anima, we don't really need to ask at all if the soul and body are one or are united, because clearly they are. And he gives a metaphor that's nice, that is helpful, like in a sort of glimpse to get his notion, which is that just as the eye and the power to see are not separable things, you can't see without an eye. And furthermore, which is a little bit less ordinary, Aristotle thinks if your eye is not helpful in enabling you to see, if you're blind, let's say, it's not actually an I, that thing there. It needs to have that capacity because that's the ergon or the defining function of an I, is to enable you to see. That's what an I is. It's an instrument for seeing with. And so just as the power to see and the eye, the organ with which you see, cannot be separated, likewise, the soul overall of a human being and a human body are not things that are separate entities. It wouldn't make sense to think of the power of sight as if it were some thing, and then the eye as if it were some other thing, and as if then we would puzzle over, like, how are they related, and that would be all confusing. That's not really the notion that Aristotle has in mind at all, and I think most people do.
Okay, I have great reservations about disclosing what's in my head right now, but I feel compelled to do so, because some recent work in neuroscience, actually the work of Paul Baccarita, shows that actually you can. One thing that he says is, we see with our brains, not with our eyes. And just to keep it as simple as possible, the senses are really like these various data ports where information from the environment is coming in. And what Paul Baccarita, he did this thing called sensory substitution. And so he showed that actually you can take the input that the eye is responsible for sending to the certain part of the brain, responsible for seeing, and you can get that input in through another data port, such as the tongue, and you can see that way. Both of us were students of Daniel Kolak, and he would often say the eyes are not windows. You can see why I was very reticent about disclosing this, but like, let's just say, you know, a human being, can we just say, like, a human being is like a big data port, and so there's all this information coming in, and like, whatever, the soul is involved in that activity, and you can't separate the two.
Yes, I mean, basically, the apprehension and the sort of awareness of that whole experience of absorbing information or sensory experience or whatever you want to call it is, yes, integral to what a human being is, but then there is that extra dimension that is the peculiar thing that is our humanity, which is when that sense experience is taken in, what happens to it? How is it, you know, almost hesitant to say processed, but how is it taken in? How is it considered or regarded or judged or interpreted, basically?
Or assimilated?
Assimilated into an understanding of what it is or how the world is. That's a thing that human beings can do in a way that, in Aristotle's view anyway, other living things can't do. We can take in sensory information and sensory experience and assimilate it into our understanding of how the world is in a different way than animals can. So that process of just the sense perception in the ordinary, most basic sense is obviously something that involves the body. You're right. You're pointing out that, like, it might involve the body in a complicated way, and maybe actually you don't need an eye to see, because if your brain is stimulated in the right way, somehow, even without your eye, you might still see something in a way. But nevertheless, we require organs of some kind to take in the information, as it were. That obviously involves the body. The thing that is more critical to our point here is that also that other dimension that is the specifically human thing of regarding things in a certain way when they're experienced is also involved in how the body is constituted, like inwardly. In Aristotle's view, in sense perception, we absorb sense sensible forms, as he would describe them, the way things look and sound and feel and all the sensory qualities of things, are preserved, as it were, in our blood, in his viewpoint. The blood is, to some extent, like the nerves in Aristotle's view, that things seep inward through your body into your heart, and there an image is constructed, or some kind of perceptible representation is presented that is the vehicle for our thought and understanding.
Right, and that's just not... That's not that different from the contemporary understanding, which sees this as like electrical impulses traveling through the nervous system and
right,
going to our brain.
True.
But, okay.
Although Aristotle's picture of the specifics is very different, I think it's worth saying. It might seem like, why even think about this or study what Aristotle has to say here, because it's like obviously not correct. I mean, we don't really transmit the information through our blood, and so what's the use of this? The use would be in the conceptual way that he understands the embodiment of cognition, basically. It's true he has a different story than we do about how that actually takes place, but the embodiment of cognition is a critical element of Aristotle's philosophy, and I think actually he's on the cutting edge of modern-day science in putting that idea forth.
We actually have a caller, and I don't know, do you hear some static? Because I'm hearing static.
I have suddenly heard static, but...
Yeah, so caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm the one with the static.
Oh my goodness. Why?
Why? I don't know. Talk to my phone company.
Are you using Skype, or are you using a landline or cell phone? Or
I'm very, very secretive.
Okay. I take it that you're using Skype then. So there is some static, so we apologize to our listeners for that, but do you have a question or comment about Aristotle's view of virtue?
I don't even know his view on virtue. I don't even care. I'm the kind of person that, as I said before, I'm a person who accepts philosophy if it helps me today, if it helps me in a pragmatic way. I presume Aristotle's view on virtue would somehow be okay during his time, maybe even our time. But when Aristotle said that he believed, unless I'm wrong, he believed that everything was made out of particles, and I'm asking myself, how would he know that without any type of instrumentation at that time? I'm saying this guy leaps to conclusions. So I don't know. I don't know what his view is on virtue. I'd have to hear it for me to have an opinion.
Okay, well, that's what we've been talking about. So are you just joining in the conversation now? Have you not been listening?
No, I just got here now, and luckily you just picked me up at the same time I came.
Okay. So, anyway, is this Joe?
Yeah, Hope, yeah.
Okay, hi.
How you doing?
Hi again. How are you doing? So what we're about to talk about actually is the role that the body plays in virtue. And what we've said so far is that Aristotle views virtue as intimately tied up with the body, and that it has something to do with living as a virtuoso, that there's some form of living, or form of life, if you will, that exhibits mastery, and virtue is connected with that. And what we're talking about is that, whatever that is, living with mastery. What we've said is it has something to do with these sort of aha moments, these moments of clarity that all of us, as Mike said, experience in our lives, but the virtuous person experiences these aha moments in a more systematic, regular way, that his life is sort of fully packed with such things. And we were talking about the body, and right now I just want to transition to, and the static is really bad, is there any way that you could call back?
Okay, if it's that bad, because I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, I've
been
to other shows, and
it's a cacophony.
Really? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, since I don't know anything about it, Aristotle's view on virtue, I'll just call back another time then.
Okay, well, listen in, and you know, if you feel so moved, call back in and we'll deal with the cacophony.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Okay, yeah. Definitely difference in terms of static. So you want to say anything?
Well, you were explaining that the body has an integral role in achieving virtue for Aristotle. If virtue is related to this sort of sustained aha moments, as it were, I think it's interesting and beautiful, actually, to get for just a second into sort of some of the Greek, or just actually one Greek word that Aristotle uses that is part of his definition of virtue. Oftentimes, it's irrelevant in any sort of immediate sense what is the Greek word that Aristotle uses, but oftentimes there are like nuances there that are very beautiful and that can't be captured directly in English translation immediately, and it's helpful to introduce it. So the Greek word that Aristotle uses when he identifies, you know, like what kind of a thing is virtue for a human being, is this term hexis. Often it's translated as like a state of a thing, or of a person, a state of character. I think it's worth pointing out right here, and without getting into all the sort of complicated details, that this word originates from a verb that means like to take hold of a thing and to make it your own property even. So virtue is a kind of characteristic of a human being in your soul when you like take hold of something and make it your own. You actively like hold on to it. Holding on to the thing is like part of the meaning of this word. So when that like aha sort of condition is something that you grasp onto and make yours and keep it and stay there and maintain that kind of state of mind, this is what Aristotle has in mind as being what virtue is like. It's like not just having it once in a while accidentally, but making it yours, that state of illuminated clarity.
That's cool, and that actually, I think, is a great transition to, you know, as I mentioned in the beginning, we had sort of like three pieces to our objective. One is to talk about the body. The other is to talk about repetition and practice and the development, and as I'll let the cat out of the bag now, if you haven't already gotten it, the development of this systematic aha moment form of life. So the role of repetition and practice in making that your own, as you're saying, and also the role that pain and discomfort plays therein. And so, as we said before, like all of us have these moments of clarity. Can you just think of an example, actually, like from popular culture or maybe from a movie where this is happening?
An example of an aha moment. Well, just as to illustrate that idea, not per se as an example that illustrates, you know, virtue necessarily, but to illustrate the sort of insight or illumination or like getting it, basically finding something out, in a sense. One example would be, most people have probably by now seen the movie The Silence of the Lambs, I would think. So I'm not.
And if you haven't, you should definitely see it.
Yes. So there's a scene in that film where, to put a long story short, Jodie Foster and this FBI agent, forget his name in the movie. His name is something or other. Let's just call him the FBI agent.
I believe the actor is Scott Glenn.
Okay.
Anyway.
Jodie Foster is in search of Buffalo Bill and is looking for just evidence that he committed certain whatever heinous crimes, and the FBI agent, her boss, believes that Buffalo Bill lives in a certain place somewhere else. And in the particular scene I have in mind, the FBI director stakes out this house and breaks in, expecting to find Buffalo Bill, and instead finds just a completely empty house, and there's nothing there. And in this one moment of just looking at an empty house, I mean, his perception, you know, strictly speaking, is just an empty house. I mean, it's all he literally sees. It's just an empty house. But a whole mass of information is put together, as it were, in one instant, and he realizes, like, oh, my God, you know, Starling or Jodie Foster is actually in the place where Buffalo Bill himself really is, and she's in trouble, and so on. So this sort of example of just looking at some empty house and all, you know, in an instant, like immediately, he didn't, like, sit there and say, okay, let's sit down and map this out now. Where is Buffalo Bill? Blah, blah, blah. Mm. All in an instant, it's kind of like, quote, unquote, put together in just one perception that, et cetera, Jodie Foster is in some place, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So a whole complicated thing that takes a long explanation to put forth is, like, seen, as it were, in just one instant of, like, realizing something.
Mm. Right.
That's one example.
Right, and like this thing, I think you alluded to it, this aha moment is not, like, the type of aha moment that you're talking about is not the type of aha moment that one gets from, for example, doing a mathematical proof where you're following, like, specific steps and blah, 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 but rather there's this instant where everything comes together. And I think that's important to make this distinction that these different types of aha moments.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the question is, okay, we've said we all have this experience. Maybe some people never have the experience of the aha moment that comes with doing a deductive proof. But clearly people have the experience of this other thing where things come together in an instant. But Aristotle, as we've been saying, thinks that, you know, the good life is one where that is one's own, one makes that one's own, and such that that sort of experience becomes more regular and systematic. And so the final question is alluding to the second piece of our objective, which has to do with practice and repetition. And so I was just wondering if you could say a little bit about the role that that plays.
Sure. Let's see. I mean, there would be many facets to the problem, obviously, of essentially, it seems like you might be asking, in effect, how is one to achieve that? Aristotle is very explicit right up front in Book 2, Chapter 1 of Nicomachean Ethics, that the way that virtue is attained, he asks, you know, how is it acquired? Is it like a God-given thing, or what is it? And explains, in a word, practice or exercise or repetition of virtuous actions with a certain kind of understanding that they are virtuous, this kind of thing. As we were saying, you know, we've all had those moments, and to sustain them and make them your own requires not only, you know, many different things, and it would be impossible to say in any kind of, like, instruction, you know, how would that be achieved. Aristotle is there's an ongoing theme in Aristotle and many other sources as well, that the kind of knowledge that can be acquired in ethical philosophy is limited in its precision in terms of explaining how to live, because there are too many unexpected particularities that any individual human being will face that require that person right then and there to just kind of know and see and have that aha realization about how it's best to act in a certain kind of situation. It can't be reduced like an instruction. There can be guidelines, but it's always finally left to the agent who acts to see what it is right to do, like in this situation.
Okay. We actually have we have a caller, and there's only 10 minutes left. I thought we would let the caller on. So,
yeah.
Caller, are you there?
Hello, I am here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, you're loud and clear. You got a question or a comment?
Yeah, I know you guys got 10 minutes and you're trying to wrap up with this repetitious thing, and I guess I just want to kind of clear up my understanding of what you mean by the aha moment. And as you were saying, philosophy has this trouble with precision in prescribing what is good for the individual or how to live best. And it seems like there's I've been studying Mill, and he I'll just read it. He views human nature as not a machine to be built after a model and set to do exactly the work prescribed for it, but a tree which requires to grow and develop itself on all sides according to the tendency of the inward forces which make it a living thing. And so it seems like the aha moment, as you described, of the FBI agent is very particular to a certain set of circumstances that one finds themselves in. And I guess is there, for Aristotle, is the aha moment a more less personalized thing? Is it more broad that we should be having this aha moment in a certain kind of medium or a certain interpretation, I guess? I don't know if I'm articulating
that. Yeah, so you're saying, like, is it more sort of individualistic based on one specific circumstances, or is there, like, also this global aspect to it?
Right.
Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Mike, do you want to take that?
Damn, awesome question.
Mm-hmm. And also awesome passage.
Yeah. Basically, both. I think that Aristotle would say, Aristotle distinguishes between different kinds of virtue or different aspects to complete mm-hmm. virtue, and explains that there is ethical virtue or virtue of character, and intellectual virtue or virtue of different forms of thinking and insight and, like, realization. And so when it comes to action and what you are to do, this always takes place in a particular set of circumstances. And so this requires insight into, like, my situation right now. And no one else can ultimately discern what that is from afar or from any other sort of general instruction. But when it comes to certain other kinds of realizations about things that are, like, eternally true, that don't concern with, like, what I should do right now, but things like, paradigm example people like to give is, like, mathematical truths are not dependent on any particular circumstances. And it's
right.
about, like, being in its essence and different metaphysical things, in Aristotle's view, are the kind of things that are not really, like, your personal insights per se, but are, in some sense, where it goes far out into very deep metaphysical sort of ideas. The insights, in some sense, transcend your human individuality, let me just put it that way, and involve, like, as Aristotle says, the mind in the universe. So there's
okay.
a kind of, like, universal type of insight that is forever illuminated in Aristotle's view, and that's God in his perception or his view. And so in some sense, to have insight into these, like, ultimate matters is not really a personal thing. But when it comes to, like, how do I take any kind of an insight like that and translate it into, like, what I am to do right now, like, no one can really tell you that, or no general abstract instruction can give you the way. You just have to know kind of how to see it in your circumstances. So it's kind of like both. Sorry for that long answer.
Yeah.
No, like, it made sense. I totally got it.
Yeah, and Aristotle does make a distinction between the practical sciences and the theoretical sciences. And so, you know, both categories of knowing, if you will, have different flavors of aha.
Okay,
right.
Yeah.
And clearly, like, this notion that Mike was talking about before, where there's no algorithm, and Aristotle specifically says that, like, there's something very peculiar that is an integral component of virtue and flourishing, and that's, like, one type, but it's an indispensable type, I would say, although that's a matter of scholarly debate. We don't want to get into that. But do you want to follow up there?
Yeah, I have another question. I don't know, you guys are pretty short on time here, so...
All right, go ahead. I put the painting out, you know, up front, and if worst comes to worst, Mike and I will just have a show on that.
That sounds good. I'd be interested in listening to that.
Okay.
But my question is, as you were talking about this aha moment, and you used the example of the FBI agent, and the aha moment was in direct time with the experience of him walking into this empty house, and it immediately clicked. And as for me, I recently had an aha moment, but it didn't occur while the experience of what triggered the aha moment, it didn't happen then. It actually happened the next day when I was reflecting on it that the aha moment clicked. And so I was thinking in the case of the FBI agent, imagine had he gone to that house, been really puzzled, then that next day all of a sudden the aha moment comes. So is there, for Aristotle, is there this time constraint on when, like, the aha moment is pure, I guess, you know? So is there, like, a time constriction, or?
You know, that's a good example and a good point. And, yeah, it always is kind of a bummer to have that aha moment, you know, later, after the fact. You know, if some action is required, like right away, and later you
right.
realize what I could have done or what I should have said or such and such, you know. Yeah, I think that, you know, definitely, again, there's like a kind of spectrum, and we move along, you know, in all different variety of situations where sometimes a sort of action is required, like immediately, and if you're going to act wisely, you need that aha moment to be like on and ready right then.
Right.
And other plans and kind of decisions about what to do are not things that you need to make a sort of commitment to immediately. Like if you're deciding sort of what to study in college or something, it's like you're not sitting there necessarily like I must decide this right now. You can like mull it over and so on and so forth. But the fact that the situations that we're in are like shifting in an unpredictable way, more or less, means that you need to be prepared for making a decision, and you can't always sort of have that leisure to rethink things over.
And
so the readiness...
Sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
I feel compelled to jump in because we have 3 minutes left, and
okay,
now it says two. But like, yeah, the reason why whatever FBI agent, whatever his name is, Scott Glenn, actor, has it in an instant, I would argue, is because of his acquired skill and practice at that activity. And so, you know, this goes back to the thing that we were supposed to be talking about in the last part, but I predicted we wouldn't get here. But just to sort of allude, like wave some hands, yeah, so it's like you have to practice this thing. And the more and more you practice it, the more it is in sync with, you know, the time at which you have to make that decision. But that practice only comes about through, guess what, pain.
Right.
And you know, and a very intense kind of training, and I would say, you know, emotional training, which, you know, we did get to it at the end, but have very little to say about it with a minute remaining. So that's all I had to say, and I'm going to be quiet henceforth.
Yeah.
I guess
I agree, and that's right on point.
I guess I will just make this last point and then shut off. And a really good show, guys. But luckily, it wasn't one of those cases where, you know, I needed to make the decision right there. However, having the realization, the moment, or the next day, I think kind of took away from the experience I could have had in that moment had I realized what was really going on. And so I think there's also a value in having the aha moment within that moment all the time, regardless of kind of, I guess, the circumstance of it, because it enhances one's ability to experience that moment as it's most authentic, I guess.
Yeah, and just going back to what Mike was saying in the beginning, like this idea of, you know, making this systematic and one's own does not happen by itself, but only with a kind of practice, which we did not get into, but perhaps that's a forthcoming show. But, yeah, like, that's the goal, like, what you're talking about is to make it there as much as possible. Would you agree, Mike?
I would, and I would throw in, just if possible, in the last 25 seconds or whatever, to have that aha at the very last moment of your life about how you should have lived, that would be like the ultimate, you know, thing you would hope to not face.
Oof.
So when it comes to how to live your life overall, that's the thing that you need to, like, spark up and fire up and keep going and fuel and live your life well and wisely and beautifully.
All right. Well,
very good.
Yeah, 5 seconds left, and so we're going to close it out, and thank you, Mike, and this
thank
is Nick, right?
Much,
yeah, yeah, thank you, thank you.
All right, and yeah, so everybody have a great evening, and we'll be back next week.
Great.
All right.
Bye.
Good night. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Hello.